Welcome to High Noon, where we talk about controversial subjects with interesting people. And I'm so happy to have back Rachel Bovard. She has been unable to share her very intelligent thoughts with all of us for some time because she was the executive director of the steering committee in the Senate, Republican steering committee. Am I doing that right? I never worked on the Hill.
Nobody knows what steering is, so it's okay.
But this is like a really important committee. Basically, she was the brains behind a realistic formulation of a conservative agenda in the Senate. Is that a fair description, Rachel?
That's fair. Yeah.
For that, she has garnered all kinds of awards. She was named one of the most powerful women in Washington under 35. And she has in between her stints in the Senate, working for folks like Mike Lee and Rand Paul, she has also been an extensive writer. She was with us over the Federalist. She has been one of the key voices in changing conservative policy around tech and corporate power. I know that she's been a key influence on me in changing my mind and some of my initial, I think, libertarian instincts several years ago on some of these questions. She really convinced me that like the structure of what we're looking at in tech is something that does demand rethinking and retooling the legal structure and really breaking out of some of the cliches of Reaganism, which I'm not an anti-Reaganite, but that really seem not to fit or describe the way the world is as we observe it around us. So with that very long introduction, Rachel, welcome back to High Noon.
Very happy to be here with you.
So we are going to get to tech structure in a minute, which I think there's nobody better to ask some of the questions I have But before that, I wanted to ask you, since you did just come out of the Senate, there have been these high-profile battles. Mitch McConnell is on his way out. But I wanted to ask you institutionally, what is your overall, like, very 10,000-foot impression of how the Senate is actually functioning or not functioning today? Because it seems to a lot of Americans, if we look at poll after poll, survey after survey, they have no confidence whatsoever in Congress writ large. They have no confidence whatsoever that the legislative branch is relevant or is actually addressing any of the problems in the country. It just seems like broken to so many Americans. So why do you think that is? And what is your assessment of the institutional health of the Senate in 2024?
Well, I think two things. I mean, first, Congress has been complicit in its own demise, right? It was envisioned as one of the most muscular branches of the three. And it's just over the decades, everyone's kind of familiar with the analogy of just trading away its own power via the regulatory state, right? Every bill that it passes just sends authority to the regulators for implementation, for all these things that Congress then never again oversees. And so policy really isn't made in Washington anymore. It's made in it is made in Washington, but it's made in the various executive branch agencies. But there's another area that I think is less discussed because it's a more modern development, but that is the emphasis on the Senate as a nominations confirmation factory. And this kind of goes directly to Mitch McConnell's legacy to some extent, because everyone says, you know, Mitch gets credit for all these conservative judges. And it's, you know, it's true. He and Trump really made that a priority. But and to do that, McConnell finished what Harry Reid started, Harry Reid, the former Democratic Senate leader, in dismantling the executive branch filibuster. So not just the judicial filibuster, but all for cabinet nominees and executive nominees. They're not confirmed at 60 votes anymore. They're confirmed at 51. And that has really moved the focus. Like it's a binary decision that was made by Mitch McConnell to say, I'm not going to, because you have a limited amount of floor time, right? I'm not going to spend that floor time on legislation. I'm not going to spend that floor time on policy. I'm going to spend that floor time on confirmations. And so we're not going to do anything creatively in the legislative space. We're just going to confirm people so they can do it for us, essentially, was the wager. And, you know, it has always been the Senate's responsibility to do confirmations, but it's now an overdrive. And you're seeing Schumer take the same approach. I mean, yes, he does legislation. Yes, he does things. But the majority of the time in the Senate is just spent rubber stamping this administration's nominations. And so it's led to things, to situations like, you know, yes, we got this tremendous ruling out of the Supreme Court to overturn Roe, but the legislative body whose job it was to respond to it had nothing to say. right? They're there taking credit for putting the people on the Supreme Court to overturn Roe, but their job was actually to come up with what does post-Roe America look like, to have a coherent agenda, a policy agenda for what that is, and they didn't engage in that debate at all. So the incentives have become completely distorted. You know, and people have different views on this in terms of McConnell's legacy of conservative judges. And, you know, you can give him a lot of credit for it, but I think this should also be pointed out. The Senate doesn't legislate anymore. It's just a confirmation factory, and that is a direct result of the fact that you now confirm nominations at 51 or simple majority instead of 60. That isn't hard. That's called scheduling the vote. When you have over 51 senators, there's nothing hard about that.
It seems like what you're describing is less a legislative branch and more like a Democratic stamp. I mean, small d Democratic stamp pass through for an empowered court and an empowered executive branch.
Right. No, we have the weakening legislature has led to an incredibly muscular judiciary and basically an empowered executive. We don't, and the kind of the two-party system looks at it now like this too. It's like, you know, we don't plot our agenda in Congress anymore. We simply wait for the next partisan president. And what I mean is, you know, if you're Democrat president, Republican, a Republican president, and then we're going to get things done because everything's going to be done by executive order because Congress is dysfunctional. And it doesn't have to be this way. I think that's what people fail to understand about the Senate is they look at, oh, everything is blocked. Everything is filibustered. Well, not really, right? When's the last time you turned on C-SPAN 2? What is happening on the Senate floor? Nothing. And that is because the leaders keep the floor in stasis. No one's actually doing a talking filibuster. Right? They're filibustering by quorum call. It's the clerk reading the names very, very slowly. And, you know, part of it is that no one wants to do the actual work of legislating anymore. They just assume, oh, we don't have 60 votes to overcome a quote unquote filibuster, which is, you know, to invoke cloture on a question. And so we just simply won't put it on the floor. There's not any of the like actual work of the legislative process, which is deal making, which is horse trading, which is also exhausting and the minority. And this is built into the Senate's rules. You can push anything through the Senate floor and you can make your opposition stay up all night and talk and object and, you know, force them into a physically grueling process until they're exhausted, right? Trent Lott had this great quote, former leader of the Senate. He used to say there are only two rules in the Senate. One is unanimous consent and the other is exhaustion. And you don't get to the first until you've reached the second. Right. And no, we don't have that kind of legislator anymore. We have legislators that want to work 2.5 days a week, not past 5 p.m.
So really your contention is that a whole lot more could be done, even with the partisan sort of divide the way that it is, even with the, you know, the kind of gridlock that we've taken for granted. Your assertion here as somebody who would know is actually we could be doing more. In the Senate, it's a matter of choice, really, and maybe not wanting to be the jackass that keeps everybody there overnight.
Well, no, it's exactly right. Like everybody, you know, I think sort of novice observers of the Senate say, well, we have to change the rules. We have to get rid of the filibuster. We have to do all this stuff. The rules themselves provide plenty of opportunity to break the will of your opposition without overturning any of its rules. If you think the last time I really saw this happen in my own career history was when Harry Reid passed Obamacare. And if you remember, he kept the Senate, the Republicans were resisting, and he kept the Senate in nights and weekends. He said, fine, you want to obstruct? I will keep you here all day, 24/7, and I will not let you go. And he broke us, right? That was the last time I've actually seen the rules used to that effect, where it's like, okay, you say you want to obstruct? Fine, you're going to be here all night. You know, you're going to have to talk and use all of your time on every single amendment, or we're going to put the question. And that is the Senate of old, but it's been a long time since we've seen that. And again, it goes to the sort of will of the legislators themselves. And frankly, the Senate is lazy. Senators are lazy. I'm not saying, you know, that's exclusive to any party in particular. It's just a fact.
Yeah. I mean, it seems like, like you shouldn't get the benefits of the empowered minority without having to work for them, right? Like that's sort of the trade-off. But even more than the physical work and the laziness, like you have to really put yourself on record. If you're keeping all these people and you are obstructing something in particular. I'm thinking now actually also to the Obama debate, like Obamacare debate, like Ted Cruz coming and filibustering Obamacare. And people laughed at that and thought it was like a total failure. I didn't think of it that way at the time because he focused the entire country and forced focus on the issues that he had with Obamacare for like days.
Yeah.
And the news would tune in and be like, okay, Ted Cruz is reading Cat in the Hat again on but he really focused the whole country on the issue. Now ultimately he was in the minority and you know he failed to prevent the passage of that law. But I didn't see that as like I saw that actually as a kind of demonstration of what you're talking about. Like actually one member has enormous power to hold up the proceedings, to focus the country on a particular aspect of the myriad of bills and amendments and debates that are happening in Washington, D.C. at any given time. I mean, that is a lot of power.
No, it is. And this is unique to the Senate in particular, because in the House is set up so the majority can crush the minority, right? That's the purpose of the House. It's supposed to be, it's the more populous body. And so its rules are set up. So the majority rules, that's the end of discussion. But in the Senate, it's almost the opposite, right? Minority members are incredibly empowered. Individual members are incredibly empowered. The only right that the Senate majority leader has over anyone else in the body is the right of priority recognition on the Senate floor, which simply means if two members are seeking recognition at the same time, the majority leader gets it before anyone else. That's literally it. Now, we defer a lot of authority, or as senators, they defer a lot of authority to the respective leaders to like schedule things and keep the trains running. And that makes a lot of sense. But it doesn't preclude individual senators from utilizing those rights. And you saw it most recently when I was the executive director of a steering committee. Roger Marshall, who a senator from Kansas, made a what we called a rogue motion to proceed to the House passed Israel bill, which was being blocked by McConnell and Schumer together. But there were a number of conservative senators that wanted to vote on this bill because they said, look, I don't want to wait for Israel aid to, you know, because it was bundled at the time or still is with Ukraine and Taiwan and all these other issues. I think we should vote on this by itself. And he was able to find a gap in the floor, get recognition, move to proceed to the bill, and he forced the entire chamber to vote on it. And that's just, that's the power one senator has. And it was hard, right? It was like, that's by the way, been on my bucket list to do for 10 years, but it was hard to do. But that just goes to show you, any senator can lean into that. You know, and again, when the Senate passed the big giant supplemental spending bill of Ukraine, Taiwan, Israel, and a bunch of other issues, you saw the conservative senators say, we might not beat this vote, Democrats, but we're going to make you stay in all night. And so for all night on the floor, you saw Rand Paul, Mike Lee, Roger Marshall, Eric Schmidt, J.D. Vance, Ron Johnson, all of them were talking all night to force Democrats to be there. Because again, the goal was, okay, we might not be able to beat you, but we're going to make it painful because the rules allow us to do that. And that's the kind of fight I think the base wants to see, frankly. They just want to know you're alive and that you care. They don't expect you to win every time, but they do expect you to lean into it.
Yeah, you know, I've always thought that was unfair, you know, the years that I spent in D.C. sort of around these legislative discussions, despite never being on the Hill for employment, was there's this like feeling that people are totally unreasonable and that they expect a minority party to be able to deliver their entire agenda. And I never felt that was true, at least talking to, you know, talking to people I've never met, frankly, somebody who was not cognizant of limitations when their party was in the minority or expected that, like, I don't know, a slim House majority was going to be able to set the agenda for the entire country when the other, you know, other branch is Democratic controlled and we have a Democratic president. I feel like the more common sentiment by far was what you just expressed, which is, I don't even see you fighting. So what would it look like for a Republican Party that at least tangentially represented the interests of its base, let's say in the minority in the Senate, look like? Like, what might that give us a vision of what it might look like if our Republican representatives actually took the concerns of the base seriously?
Well, I think just an extremely low baseline for that would be Republican senators banding together and saying, if Chuck Schumer is going to deny our conference amendment votes, because he frequently does that, which is just antithetical to the Senate as a deliberative body. If he's going to say we get no amendments, he's going to fill the amendment tree, then Republican senators are going to vote against cloture on this bill, and they're going to take down the bill. Because people forget, they think that in the Senate you need 60 votes to pass anything. In reality, you only need 41 votes to block something, right? And that sends it back to the negotiating table. So if 41 senators can get their lives together and vote against cloture on a bill, that bill doesn't go anywhere. And it forces the two parties back together to negotiate. That would be a baseline for what Republicans in the Senate could do to stand up for each other's rights. And, you know, every now and then they'll do it on a bill that's like not that serious. But on the must-pass bills, on the appropriations bills, on the supplemental bills, you know, the term uniparty gets thrown around a lot, but it's actually not that incorrect, for lack of a better term, to describe the relationship that McConnell and Schumer have had over the last year, right? When they agree on something, it's like rights of other members be damned. And I don't think that's how the Senate should run. You know, I think at the very least, like I said, the base doesn't expect you to win, but they expect you to spill some blood, right? They expect you to go on the field, leave some blood on the field, and when you're done, be battle weary. And that's really kind of what we don't see, I would say, frankly, from the House or the Senate Republicans at this point.
Yeah, I mean, that's what makes people believe that these are just there's no difference. These are just a bunch of guys who are friends who want to leave at 5 p.m. And there's a lot of truth to that. Like, they're just that the battles they have over legislation are really just shadow boxing. And the number of, I think the single most dispiriting thing that I learned in Washington, D.C., compared to my very, I came in as an intern, very enamored with the constitutional system of America and all the very Bill on Capitol Hill kind of thing.
Oh, same. It was all of us.
Yeah. Was the number of votes that are just fake.
Oh yeah.
Like the fact that, I mean, the most obvious example I keep coming up with that really can, like, it dates me. All the battles that I come up with legislatively are all from the Tea Party era. But like the fact that the Republican Party voted so many times when it didn't control the White House or didn't control both chambers to repeal Obamacare. And then the second that it was real, the votes completely disappeared into thin air.
This happens so many times. We call it failure theater because it's meaningless, right? When you know it's not going to go anywhere, it's fine to vote for it. But the minute it becomes real, it's like everybody scatters. But the best example of this, and again, this is my sort of gripe, for lack of a better term, with McConnell's legacy, is votes on pro-life issues. They are the most fake votes that Republicans take because they're always standalone bills set up on a Monday night. Monday night votes, by the way, are called bed check votes because they're fly-in day, right? The members are coming back to Washington from their weekends at home. They never really whip attendance. They rely on the vote to tell them who is in town. So it's, you always schedule something that you don't actually care if it passes or not, or you know it's going to pass by such a high margin that you don't need everybody there. So you're already scheduling it as a bed check vote. You don't whip it, and you put like a judge confirmation behind it, because you know the vote's going to fail. That's every single pro-life vote in the United States Senate for the last 20 years. And the real pro-life votes would be germane amendments on appropriations bills, right? Defunding Planned Parenthood on appropriations bills. This is why there was such a big consternation over what Tommy Tuberville did, the senator from Alabama, when he was blocking consent on all these tranches of military nominations, because for the first time in literally two decades, someone had made the pro-life fight real on Capitol Hill. And his own party turned on him for it. But those are classic examples of head fakes, of failure theater, where you get a ton of credit for voting for this bill that's not real, that's never whipped, and is designed to fail. That stuff drives me nuts, but that's like 80% of Capitol Hill.
Yeah, I'm starting to get a sense that the legislative branch in this country might be broken.
Well, no, the way to fix it is for people to understand how this works and see through it and call bullshit on it. Sorry if I'm not allowed to say that on this podcast.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it is, that's what it is. It's an accurate description. But yeah, I think that was the most disillusioning thing because it's so cynical, right?
It's so cynical. Yes.
It's so incredible. It's not just that maybe there are some issues that you yak about on the campaign trail that like you just don't see them going anywhere in the legislature. So you don't focus on them. It's just like a direct insult to.
Well, and these are like, the pro-life issue isn't a fringe issue. It's a Republican Party platform issue that they all commit to. And then, you know, they all go along with the total charade of failure theater on these votes on Capitol Hill. And they never lean into the fight on any must pass bill. So the National Defense Authorization Act, any of the appropriations bills, you will never see a pro-life fight on those bills because that's when it would actually be real, right? Then you're shooting with real bullets. But we can't do that because those bills, the Uniparty wants to pass those bills.
Before we turn to big tech, I want to ask you one more question about the Senate and the legislative process, which is, I feel like often when we chat about various policy issues, whether we do it on podcasting or on a group chat, I feel like half the time your answer is, well, if we took appropriations seriously, we could do something about this, but we don't. So how are Republicans failing to use that tool? Because you just mentioned it in the pro-life context, right? Like what about introducing an amendment to just strip funding from Planned Parenthood or whatever? Like how successful why do you think that would be a successful way of going about things given everything else you've said about like the sort of the ability to make life difficult for everybody else in the Senate if you're really dedicated to something?
Yeah, I mean, people don't understand that the appropriations bills are like the locus of Congress's entire power, right? That is their one constitutional responsibility that they take somewhat seriously, which is funding these agencies, but also controlling what is done with the funding. And so what makes it so offensive when they draft these bills, you know, behind closed doors with like four people, and the rest of the conference doesn't see them, is that all of the tyranny that's happening around us today, all of the corruption at the FBI, at the DOJ, the lack of a secure border at DHS, all of that is funded by Congress, which means it's funded in our name. And people are doing absolutely nothing about it. And in fact, they're in the process right now. The Hill is in the process of rubber stamping these bills with no changes to those policies. I guarantee you every Republican ran on, or most of them anyway, on controlling the corruption at DOJ, on getting a secure border, and yet they're about to vote for these bills that do nothing, which is the area where they could actually control the problem, and they're doing nothing. So the first step, right, is for the House Republican majority to lean into some of these policy rider fights and say, no, we are not voting for a bill that doesn't address DHS border policies, and we're not even going to put a bill on the floor unless it does those things. And you force Democrats to take down the bill, right? If you put a secure border bill on the floor with DHS that says that controls what the secretary can do at the border, makes, you know, him institute the policies that actually work, if Democrats want to vote against that and shut down the government, okay, right? We always start from the premise of, well, we don't have 60 votes in the Senate, but President Biden's never going to sign that. Democrats will never vote for it. One of the key aspects, and this is, I've never been in a war, but this is probably true as true in war as it is in parliamentary practice, is you never know how a fight is going to end until you wage it, right? That's the kind of amazing, super fun thing about working in politics, is that it's so variable, right? There's so many different things that can happen at any different moment, and you never know how the fight is going to end until you actually fight it. So do it. So put a baller DHS bill on the floor and say in the House and say, Democrats, you don't want to support this? Fine. You want to shut down the government? We'll wait. Right. And go toe to toe on this stuff. But you have instead House Republican leadership and, you know, an establishment Republican Party who is just like, well, we don't want to do that. We don't want to wage that fight. We don't have to. Biden will never sign it. Like, it, rather than putting their opposition on the defensive, we just accept their terms.
Yeah, that seems to describe so much of the frustration, I think, on the right. And it goes well beyond the legislative process. It's just there's such a feeling, I think, a correct one among conservatives that the terms of the battle are always dictated to us, right? Like the framework is always dictated to us. And then we have to take essentially the Hail Mary, like, structurally disadvantaged position. And that's true. That, like, that might make sense on some issues if you imagine that Democrats have, like, overwhelming support of the country on this or that. Or, but, like, it seems the case, even when polling shows, you know, 75-80% of people agree with Republicans on an issue, and we feel exactly the same in this defensive posture with the terms of the debate dictated to us. And I mean, I think there's probably more to that than simply the legislative, but there's this legislative piece of it that you're talking about, where ostensibly we have two parties in Washington, we have this balance of power between different branches, and then these two houses of Congress that operate very differently, and yet in each one of these venues, the same weird defensive dynamic of taking, essentially, like, taking the hand dealt on purpose by the other team, and, like, seeing that it's a weak hand and always feeling like you're holding the weak hand in any of these fights.
Anyone who tells you they can predict how a fight's going to end in Washington, it just is corrupt, basically. Like, because you just don't know the fact. And that's the fog of war changes people. The fog of war changes situations. Like, you just never know how it's going to come out. So it's like, maybe try a little, just try it. Right? Just lean into a fight and see what happens. And again, like, it's a win-win, because even if you lose, your voters are going to see that you give a damn. And that's what I think the base gets so upset about, to the point we were discussing earlier. Not that you don't win all the time, but you don't even try. And you just accept the premise of defeatism from the outset.
Yeah. So let's switch gears here. I was trying to think of a handy segue, but I could not think of one. So we're going to do this the jarring way, which is and in addition to your work, although you have worked on tech issues in the Senate, but I was not exaggerating at the beginning when I say you really changed the way that I think about tech issues, and I would say corporate power generally. So we have now a series of these debates getting teed up. Right now in Congress, there's a debate over TikTok and its connections to the CCP, which seems like a very limited debate. It's I think, on purpose, very much limited to the idea of, okay, should we have a powerful app that collects all kinds of data and shapes the views of so many young Americans that is directly feeding in to the government of our biggest geopolitical adversary. That seems like a very specific national security focused debate that makes it, in some ways, the contours of it easier. We have the net choice case in Congress. We have 230 rumblings, net choice case in the Supreme Court, and then 230 rumblings in the Supreme Court. We have a series of Justice Thomas dissents laying out common carrier suggestions for dealing with tech. It just seems like everything is very much in flux right now, in, I would say, a positive way compared to when you were able to write about these issues, because you weren't back in the Senate, let's say 2 or 3 years ago, when you were writing about these tech issues. You were very much, like, still in convincing mode, convincing people like me, like, yes, actually, this is a problem, and we need to be more ideologically flexible in the way that we address this. It seems like now there's more ideological flexibility, and I don't as often, except from places like Net Choice, which is literally a lobbying bundle of all of the companies that would be directly affected by this. I feel like there's a lot more flexibility, but no one really knows where to take it or what would be effective. So what is your, we'll start 10,000 foot and go more specific, but, like, what is your feeling about, among all these solutions, common carrier, antitrust, the censorship and free speech angle to all of this? Like, where do you think is likely to bear fruit? What are you hearing in terms of legislative solutions? What are you thinking about when you see cases like Net Choice in the Supreme Court, and you hear the justices? Basically, to me, it sounds like they don't know either. Like, Thomas is the only one who has this very kind of clear-cut way, and even though I love Thomas and I agree with him 99% of the time, I'm not wholly convinced that it's, at least, that it's the solution for all of the problems in tech. But the rest of them seem very much all over the place ideologically as to which box to put some of this power in. So how do you see all of this mess? What do you think about when you see it, as opposed to the situation 3 years ago? And how do you see it starting to resolve into some kind of picture or narrative that we could actually understand?
Well, I think the right you know, has come a long way on these questions in big, you know, big part because they've just been so abused by these platforms. And so I think they're awake to the threat in a way that they weren't, you know, 5 years ago. But I still think our debate is lagging or not fully capturing what these platforms actually are, because we still talk about, you know, the tech platforms as if they're speech platforms and as if this is an entirely First Amendment problem. And it has First Amendment angles to it, right? We saw this very clearly with some of the documents that came out of Missouri v. Biden, which was a case about the government itself putting its finger on the platforms, telling them the type of content, particularly around COVID-19 and everything else, what they could and couldn't show. Like that's a very clear cut First Amendment issue. But more broadly, you know, these platforms aren't just speech platforms. They are market actors. They're market access platforms for a lot of things. I mean, Facebook is not just where you know, your grandmother posts pictures of the family reunion. It is Facebook Marketplace. It is a huge digital advertising firm. And that's the same of Google. More than anything else, Google's a digital advertising firm. And, you know, we don't on the right tend to look at these platforms that way. But Google and Apple are huge vectors of commerce, particularly when it comes to apps, right? Like if you're not in the Google or Apple App Store, you functionally don't exist. And it's funny because the TikTok bill that they're debating in Congress this week basically says that, right? It says to TikTok, divest from ByteDance or the app stores can't sell you, because everybody knows if you're not in the app store, right? It's a recognition of the fact that if you're not in the app stores, you can't access the market. And so these are market access platforms in a way I don't feel like the debate on the right fully encompasses, because if it did, we wouldn't be simply talking about the speech problems. We'd be talking about it in a much more sort of way that's comprehensive of what these platforms are. And to me, the market dominance and the way these platforms act in the marketplace, speech is downstream of those concerns. If you want to address the speech control and the censorship and, you know, the content moderation and how it ripples, you have to control or somehow address the market dominance of these platforms and how they act as huge vectors of market access for, you know, major portions of business at this point. And, you know, I will say it's like not as sexy, right, as talking about censorship in the First Amendment, but I do think it is more reflective of what these platforms actually are. And my former boss in the Senate, Mike Lee, I didn't work on these issues for him when I was there last time, but he is ranking member of the Antitrust Subcommittee on the Judiciary Committee, put out two bills that are specific to this issue, particularly with Google. And it forces a divestiture of Google's ad agency from its search, recognizing the link between the ability to censor is linked to how dominant you are on the business side. And because as we all know, Google basically is, you know, filters information for 90% of the world. And they do this because they have a better product because they are so dominant in the ad space. So I do think that market power and speech are linked, and the rights discourse hasn't quite caught up with that yet.
Yeah, I mean, because otherwise the sort of libertarian solutions that are proposed would work.
Right. Right? If you want to build your own, you actually have to have a competitive market, and that doesn't exist right now.
So like, you know, I am still, you know, a free marketer, and my first line solution is to look, you know, for market power, to look for the consumer to be able to fix this in some way, right? And there is a kind of logic to that thinking. It's, you know, but there's a bunch of premises that just don't seem to fit, and part of that is that the market dominance that's not obvious because we look at like Facebook versus Twitter versus Instagram versus TikTok, and we think like, okay, like, and MySpace, which is gone, right? We think, okay, it does look like there's turnover in this market. It doesn't look like there's one big player. But then when we step back and look at, for example, the app market and the ability to put an app on the market, we do see that like obvious dominance of two companies. But that's why, like, because my instinct was to say, okay, so, you know, one app censors you or one company censors you, you know, you move to the other one, right? But what we saw repeatedly was okay, if you're banned off of Twitter in the previous regime, right, you're also banned off of Instagram and Facebook, which are the same company, right? You're also banned off of YouTube. You're also banned off of, right? So like they were able to just scrub people's voices. And yes, this is the downstream speech effect that I'm talking about, but like it was the collusion between all these platforms that are ostensibly competitors that made that actual censorship possible. Because otherwise, you know, somebody who has got, you know, a popular platform could just jump to the, you know, jump to the other one, and there wouldn't be nearly as much. Yes, it's annoying to be banned from either Facebook or Twitter, but the problem is when you're banned off of everything and you can no longer put your thoughts into the digital marketplace.
Yeah. Yeah. The sort of classic example of this that I always go back to is what happened to Parler. Because Parler, if you remember, was the most popular app in the App Store right before January 6th. It was the most downloaded, even though, you know, if you used it, you know, the interface wasn't great. Like it wasn't easy to, it wasn't intuitive. Right. Yeah. But like there was such a demand for, you know, Parler there was such a demand for a quote unquote free speech platform that people wanted to use it. And in an instant, right, it was banned from both app stores. Amazon was its web hosting service, dropped it. Its email service provider dropped it. I think their lawyers stopped working with them, and it was gone. It was literally snuffed out of existence because of this ideological collusion across the major access points of the market. And it's instructive for two reasons. The first, I think it just goes to show you what a cartel the tech marketplace is, right? Like the back end part of the tech marketplace, forget, you know, the individual platforms, the ability to access the market depends on like three companies. And if they turn on you, it's over. As a small business, you have no ability to exist. But the second thing is I think a new feature that we've seen, which is the ideological sorting of the market in a way, at a scale, I guess I should say, that we've never experienced before. And it's going just beyond services, but it's really getting to the guts of capitalism, the access points of capitalism. So the Google and Apple app stores are a perfect example of this, right? They're basically stores, right? It's a market front for apps in America. And if you're not in those stores because of ideological reasons, you can't make money in America. We're seeing this outside of the tech sector, though, unfortunately. The most concerning thing I've seen in the last 10 years has been the ideological weaponization of the banking system. That is terrifying to me that, you know, we now live in a world where the financial system, you know, you can't transact in a modern economy if you don't have the right views. And this is not true, you know, across the board yet, but we've seen very key examples of banks that won't do businesses with certain industries, or that credit card companies that look at your transaction history and lump you into a certain ideological category and flag you as a high risk account. Like that is, you know, the market functions on one, mutual trust, but also this sort of neutrality where anyone can do business in the free market, and that's what makes it function. We're starting to lose that. And I don't know yet that we have a coherent policy response to it.
Yeah, that's the tricky thing, right? Because it does seem like even when we talk about tech, sometimes, like you're saying, when the discussion is limited to free speech, it's itself a massive problem, right? And I agree with the digital town square comparisons, and I agree that the speech part is a massive problem. But what gets much scarier to me is that the mechanism by which this is happening, and I think collusion is the right word, but it's a kind of tacit collusion that's based on assumptions of cultural agreement mm-hmm. across, I don't even want to limit it to say the corporate class, because it's not like a bunch of billionaires who all agree with each other. Actually, if anything, if you take the like top 1% of 1% of 1%, they tend to be eccentric, and you get some Elon Musks and you get some Jeff Bezoses. And, but like, there's this thick middle of the upper class, if that makes sense. And I know, you know, Burnham called it the professional managerial class. There are people who have different terms for it, but there does seem to be this very powerful professional class that really strongly shares certain worldview assumptions that correlate with politics, and that therefore you get this kind of colluding mechanism across different sectors where you wouldn't expect it. And that's really what I see as different from the American past, right? If you think about the progressives and Teddy Roosevelt on the cusp of trust busting, which was, I feel a little more sympathy, I think, for the progressives than I used to, because I also feel like I'm looking at a new shape of a monster that didn't mm-hmm. take place before. And I think that's how they felt looking at the way that these trusts would exercise market power. But even so, you had so much diversity within different and across industries in America. You didn't have that, like the oil barons of Oklahoma did not agree with the finance barons of New York, you know, and they fought about a whole bunch of things, and they were actually more directly building up dominant market power. And that's where a lot of our antitrust structure comes from, right? That idea of very directly and for business purposes, either vertically or horizontally, integrating a huge part of any specific market. That was new, but it was at least sort of comprehensible in a financial way. What we're seeing now, it seems to me, is that same kind of market dominance of a handful of players, but it's not based on financial interest. It's based on this kind of tacit, similar worldview among a class of people, so that when Bank of America decides they don't want to bank the NRA, they can pretty much be sure that Wells Fargo will follow along, that, you know, Citibank will follow along, that once one of them, that same effect as what happens with social media, once one bank decides this is persona non grata, we don't want this customer, regardless of how much money they're going to make us, they can kind of count on all their competitors to do the same thing. There's no big bank with similar capacity that's jumping to the plate and being like, we don't care what you do, NRA. We want your cash, right?
Right. No, it's the market, or it's the financial incentive that we always relied on to move the market forward. But to your point, it's now become distorted. Like, even that most reliable of incentives, right? Greed is now distorted by this, like, need for ideological alignment or purity, or however you want to define it. And it does have downstream consequences, because, you know, people will say, oh, well, just find a local bank. Well, if I need like a massive commercial loan or some kind of like real estate loan, my local bank is not necessarily going to be able to support that. So it really does start to trickle down, into the type of people that are allowed to access the guts of capitalism, the levers of the free market. And that's a serious, serious problem that I don't think there's enough discussion about, you know, on the right. We're still stuck in the like build your own bank frame of the discourse. But at this point, we're not talking about building your own bank. We're talking about like building your own financial system and, you know, building your own service industry to some extent. And that's just not a sustainable or functional response. You're talking about two different countries at that point.
Yeah. And I want to pick up on that thread about two different countries, because that's obviously concerning. Like, if our commerce splits into two, even if that's the quote unquote solution, like, that is a very disturbing thought. But before we get off this specific point, I wanted to ask, like, I just want to bring up the point that this is one way in which these problems are clearly distinguishable from the like freedom of expression cases, right? That because you often hear from the left, well, you know, why you're being hypocritical, right? Why do you think that the baker, because he's a Christian, should be able to refuse the gay marriage cake, but you don't think that Amazon should be able to refuse to host views, like a website with views that they find,
or refuse to like sell books they don't agree with,
right?
As the world's biggest ebook retailer,
and I admit, like, there's a sort of initial, I kind of had to think about that one when that was first thrown at me. Like, why are these things different? But it's actually one of those things where not only are the legal bases for these things quite different, although they do overlap, and I think we're going to have to get to categorizing different kinds of entities. But on a practical level, it's wholly different. right? Because the fact of the matter is that the gay couple who wants the wedding cake can go to any number of bakers. It is a matter of there that consumer power mechanism really does work. And if somebody wants to take a stand for their like sort of ideological or religious purity, they can do that. They are actually losing out on a customer vis-a-vis their other competitors, right? And there you might have a sort of sorting effect. I think before we started recording, you mentioned, right, lefty bookstores, right? We've always had these businesses that definitely aligned with one side or the other. And it wasn't so much of a problem because we did have this larger market that was very, very mixed up. So any individual actor in the market, sure, like you might feel very out of place at your local coffee shop if you're a conservative living in Washington, D.C. But it's not like you couldn't get coffee down the street from, you know, a different place that wasn't as into whatever trans rights or
right.
There actually was that market mechanism to actually, you know, put your dollars with people where you felt comfortable. And that's very different from what we see on this like big institutional level or these big sectors as a whole, like banking, like, you know, social media tech as a whole, encompassing all of these platforms, or or Amazon in terms of hosting services. There's not really that ability to go next door, or frankly, to in the parlor case, to start your own coffee shop and be like, right. I'm so sick. Yeah. There must be other people who are so sick of having this politics shoved in their face. I'm just going to open the anti-political coffee shop and we're just going to sell coffee, right? There's no ability to enter the market like that.
Yeah. And I think the biggest difference between, well, I mean, there are a lot of differences, I think, between sort of the masterpiece cakes and what we're dealing with, but you kind of hit on the biggest one, which is one of scale, right? Like to your point, this is one bakery, probably across the street, you could be served just as well. And so the issue resolves. Here, we're dealing with massive consolidation in these spaces, including the financial sector, you know, including the tech sector, such that if you are not served by one of these massive sort of market access points, you literally don't have anywhere else to go. And, you know, I come back to the parlor example because what happened to it after the fact is proof of that, right? They couldn't get web hosting on Amazon. They couldn't get web hosting from like anyone. You know, they ended up with some like Russian server, right? Which was like nobody wanted to do business with, and also just was terrible and inefficient and not quality. So they technically got served, but they couldn't access. It's not like they could shop in the market and make an informed decision based on service quality about who to go to. They were ghettoized, essentially, because of their viewpoints, correct or not. People had this view of what parlor was and how they acted, and they were literally ghettoized in a free market system and unable to compete in the market because of their views. And my fear is that that is a canary in the coal mine for a lot of us unless we sort of wake up to this fact. You know, and I don't think, you know, I talk a lot about market dominance and corporate power. I don't think, you know, antitrust is the traditional remedy for that. I do think that solves some of our concern, but I don't think it's a panacea. I don't think it solves everything. I do think there is First Amendment jurisprudence here that needs to be, I think, parsed a little bit more. I do think that there are other models that we've sort of discussed, you and I off air about common carrier and things like that, that are going to have to be considered, because to the point you were making, this is an entirely new scheme and development in something that in America we've always relied on as the great equalizer, which is the free market. We have to protect that. But I think to do that, we have to recognize the threat for what this is, which is, you know, something completely new that I think is going to require a much more creative and coordinated response than we currently have.
Yeah, I mean, to the First Amendment point, it's clear to me that in the next 5 to 10 years, the court is going to have to come up with some imperfect, you know, one of the many doctrines or balancing tests that the court is always coming up with to distinguish between the spectrum of actors, of speakers rather, right? And to be able to distinguish between, for example, the 303 Creative case, which is much more like Masterpiece Bakery, masterpiece cake shop. By the way, that poor guy, I feel so terrible for him. They will not leave him alone. Like, they are going to continue to keep him in court for the rest of his life. They can't even pick a different baker. You know, like, I'm sure there's another Christian baker in America. But there's that category of sort of expressive. You can imagine the First Amendment is strongest when it's just you and the product that you're selling is something expressive. Obviously there's quite strong First Amendment protection and kind of obvious First Amendment protection. I mean, if you think about the idea of going on to Etsy and there are artists working for commission and you're like, you know, paint me a picture of a Hitler Sig hailing, right? And they don't want to do that. Right. That seems like really basic to us, unless you put it in the context of religion and then, you know, half the country has a completely bigoted reaction to it. But anyway, that seems like an obvious expression and something that should be protected by the First Amendment. And then in the middle, you have cases like Hobby Lobby, which did claim religious and First Amendment rights. But they're like a family company. Now, they're a big company, but by no means the only sort of actors in their market, but they were a family-owned, and that fact came up a lot in the briefings and in the argument, the fact that this is not a publicly traded company. This is something that this family started from scratch. It happened to get very big, but it's still all theirs. And then you have on the, like, far side, and maybe they deserve First Amendment rights. Maybe they don't, like... And then on the far end, you have something like Amazon, which is a publicly traded company that has a board of directors, right? But there's no, like, individual who has an expression about Amazon. There's a founder who made a lot of money, but the governance of Amazon is a series of abstractions, not a specific person who's expressing a specific view. But this does go to the, you know, Mitt Romney, our corporations people, kind of question. Because if we stick with the doctrine that Amazon has the exact same First Amendment rights as the Etsy painter, that those, there's no distinguishing between those two things and the way that the First Amendment can apply, well, then you basically come out in net choice as like, okay, these guys have their First Amendment right. They can kick off whoever they want, or that the bank has a First Amendment right to debank whoever they want. And if all the actors in a given market are exercising their First Amendment right to hate the NRA, well, there's no problem there, right? So, like, it's clear to me that that spectrum is something that the court is going to have to wheedle over multiple cases and getting, like, hard cases on one side or on the other. Like, where, to what extent should there be different or weaker protections for a huge publicly traded company with X amount of market share in a given given field versus the individual proprietor who is on the strongest case is doing something like artistic or expressive?
Yeah, you know, I do think that scale matters, and the type of market that you're in, and how you have the ability to cut off access for literally, like, anyone who wants it based on their viewpoint. I do think that that should weigh in here, and I think we've oversimplified the discourse, you know, because groups like NetChoice, which, you know, represent all the tech companies, intentionally distort it so that they make it a binary choice, right? Well, if you do this to Facebook, then you're doing this to every, you know, small business owner in America, you know, limiting their rights to speak. And that's not a realistic argument at this point, right? Like, I think the court or policymakers have to recognize that there is a spectrum here. Of if you are a company that is able to, you know, prevent an entire industry in the app store from even, you know, if they believe the wrong things, from accessing the app marketplace, then that seems to be like a big problem, right? Like, we're not even talking about speech at this point. We're literally talking about the ability to make money. And, you know, that's, I think, the key distinction here is we're not talking about, like, they love to analogize. And this is why I think sometimes the First Amendment jurisprudence, when you're making it just a First Amendment issue, it kind of distorts what's going on, because they love to analogize, you know, Amazon to your local bookstore. Amazon is nothing like your local bookstore. And when Amazon refuses to sell your book, that may be, like, you can couch it in a First Amendment context and say that's a speech decision, but then you're intentionally avoiding the ripple effects of that choice.
Yeah, that's the moment where because I was rereading Capitalism and Freedom like about a year ago because I was giving a talk for its 60th anniversary or something like that. And that was the moment that I was like really, I had been moving away from, for a long time, I haven't been like a pure libertarian. I've been a social conservative, but I remember reading Capitalism and Freedom and being like, yeah, no, really, these ideas do not, just do not describe the world that we obviously live in, because Milton Friedman has an entire like several pages about how the book publisher can't afford to just refuse to publish or only publish books that with which he agrees. And I was like, no, but that's exactly what's happening both in the publishing and the distribution end. Like
that man never met Jeff Bezos,
happening in the world that we live in. And you're saying that right. It's an impossibility. But it's not an impossibility, clearly, because it's happening. So I wanted to ask about some of the solutions to some of this, because even if it's the case that the solution is that basically we need Amazon Web Hosting Services, like we need a conservative AWS, and I know there are people who are interested in building that kind of service, or we need to capture one of the big giant banks for conservatism, you know, we have to do an institutional takeover the way that the woke left is, but we just need to get hired, you know, and work our way up in Wells Fargo and do a hostile takeover. Like, at what point, if you completely separate out, because what you're talking about is not just the end product, people going to a different coffee shop or a different bookstore, but working all the way up into the machinery of finance and capitalism and building all of that from scratch, even if the right were to do that, I mean, at what point do you lose, one, any semblance of nationhood between mm-hmm. people? And two, I mean, this Anglo-Protestant kind of mercantile culture of America that has bred an enormous amount of tolerance of diversity and difference in a legitimate way, exactly because the merchant has to be a little bit tolerant. You see that in like basically all merchant societies, right? Venice and, you know, in the Dutch, and like you see a certain level of tolerance simply because business comes first and very different people can transact business and go home to their very different cultures and very different homes and different worlds and still have mutually beneficial business relationships with one another. There are obviously limits to that, but that kind of tolerance that sprung out of the American tradition, I think very much has to do with people being very different people consciously putting aside some of their political or personal or religious beliefs and transacting with people who are different from them and developing relationships and developing an appreciation for people different than them through those relationships. I mean, we're going to lose all that if we have essentially parallel economies in this country.
Yeah. And that's where ultimately I think the build your own argument fails. And I don't necessarily think it was bad from the beginning. And I don't think it's bad, you know, all the time, because sometimes that is what you have to do. But the problem is it has now become the answer to, again, these like mass infrastructure of capitalism problems. Literally, we're at the point of build your own bank and, you know, build your own sort of mass service system. And it, to your point, like the logical end of that is literally two different countries. If you're operating under two different, you know, infrastructures of capitalism, you are effectively two different countries. And there are some people that are fine with that. I do think you lose America at that point, right? You lose what America has always been. And the market, you kind of lose the equalizer that has always been the marketplace, right? The great story of America from the point of view of America's opportunity has been that anyone can enter the marketplace, compete on the same playing field and rise, regardless of what your views are, regardless of your background, regardless of what kind of money you started with or didn't start with. And we're losing that because of this ideological sorting and because the people at the top, the upper echelon of the people that control the mass parts of the market that have been consolidated are now have ideological thresholds put in place and barriers to entry. That to me is a huge, huge problem that not only our courts, but our Congress should be grappling with. And yes, that will require, I think, setting aside these very dogmatic beliefs about what the market is, because the market isn't that right now. Right. And I think consolidation and just new forms of technology have changed that. It doesn't mean that we can't still hold principles about having the freest market possible. It's just that we have to recognize the reality that the market isn't the freest market possible right now. And that requires a lot of vigilance from us.
Yeah. I mean, that's really, I think what I've learned from the way that you think about these questions is just a kind of ideological humility in the face of something that is shaped differently than anything, like a creature which, you know, looks totally different than what we've seen in the past and will require a kind of flexibility to even identify and describe before you can even get to, okay, like there's clearly some dangers of the shape of the way that power, both corporate and government, is used to control people's decisions, their lives, the way they see the world, their politics, their views, who they interact with, and recognizing all of those downstream negative effects requires looking at that new creature and saying, okay, like how can we tame this creature? Right. Because the older structures are not doing it.
And I get it, and all the time people throw it at me. Well, that's what Democrats want. The conservatives would never support that. The conservative philosophy has always been one of principle, not this dogmatic attachment to policy prescription. And that's what has made it so successful and so able to address new problems when they arise is because we're not wedded at all to these like very strict and sort of ossified ways of having to solve the problem. We can recognize that, you know, freedom is the principle. Free access to the market is the principle, and we can look and say that's not happening, and now we can try to address it. And that's, I think, oftentimes the debate in DC, because, you know, corporate interests get involved and fund various sides of it in very specific terms. But at its root, that is what the conservative philosophy has always been. So I do think it is well within the conservative canon to be able to look realistically at what is happening and say, my principles say that this is, you know, not aligning with human flourishing, a free market, equal access to opportunity. How can we fix this?
Well, if I was looking for how to fix this very complicated problem, I would keep reading and listening to Rachel Bovard. Rachel, thank you so much for coming on High Noon.
It's wonderful to be back with you.
And thank you to our listeners. High Noon with Inez Stepman is a production of the Independent Women's Forum. As always, you can send comments and questions to inez.stepman@iwf.org. Please help us out by hitting the subscribe button and leaving us a comment or review on Apple Podcasts, Acast, Google Play, YouTube, or iwf.org. Look at all those corporate entities right there. Be brave. We'll see you next time on High Noon.